This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Michael McGarrity. We're here to talk about the third book in his trilogy, which is a prequel to the Kevin Kearney crime novels. The new book is called The Last Ranch. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Glad to be back. Good to see you.
And at the end of the program today, we'll be talking about all the different events that you're doing. You're doing a bunch of things coming up. This book picks up, it's a history of the Kearney family. We got to know Kevin Kearney in the many novels that you wrote in which he was our hero and detective. This picks up during World War II with Kevin Kearney not yet born. His father, Matt Kearney, is home from the war, back at the ranch. And it seems like a real transition time between the Old West and the modern world. Talk about that period.
It's a very interesting period. The post-Second World War period saw massive changes throughout our society. And we're still feeling the reverberation of that today. It hasn't stopped. But the world expanded for people coming back from the war. And they brought with them all sorts of new expectations and faced new challenges as a result of that. The war economy thrived for certain industries, particularly in agriculture and ranching, where the need for meat, cattle, agricultural products was great. Demand was great. And of course, there was rationing too. So while production was up, a lot of people had to cut back on meeting their anything but basic needs in order to be able to feed the war machine, if you look at it that way. So the ranching industry not only began to change, but in the Southwest, there was this huge negative impact of a long-lasting drought that really forced people off the land in certain cases. And some of them never came back, were never able to return to ranching. In The Last Ranch, one of the things that happened that is specific to our area here in New Mexico was the expansion of the presence of the military in the state on a permanent basis. That had a huge impact on the people that remained ranching on the Tularosa Basin, which is where a lot of the action in this book takes place. So ranchers there not only had to face the drought that lasted for 5 or 6 years, they had to face the expansion of the military testing program at what was then called White Sands Proving Ground, which opened just at the tail end of World War II. What happened as a result of that is people have been forced off that land and kept off that land for generations now without any kind of reasonable remuneration. But all around them, the world was changing. Small little cities like Las Cruces, little towns like Alamogordo were morphing into larger metropolitan areas because the military was drawing in enormous numbers of soldiers, airmen, scientists. There's this wonderful story in a book called Operation Paperclip, which deals with how the United States government illegally snuck German scientists across the Mexican border into New Mexico to help develop the V2 program, which then became the missile program for our country. So these little hamlets all of a sudden just exploded in population. A little town like Las Cruces, which maybe had 12, 15,000 people at the end of World War II, just burgeoned and grew. And of course, everybody was in favor of it. This brought jobs, it brought prosperity, it brought growth that Chamber of Commerce loved, it brought the construction industry. And then you add on top of that the development in the early 60s of the Interstate Highway Program, which was proposed and funded during the Eisenhower administration. And you had a whole change from the way we transported goods in the United States, which was primarily by rail, to using the interstate to bring goods and services into communities. It's just the revolution hasn't ended. It still continues to reverberate throughout our society. And there's probably no end in sight as we continue to urbanize.
It's interesting that you say in Operation Paperclip that German scientists were brought in illegally. It seems that when the military is involved, particularly when we read your book, anything that they want to say is legal is legal.
They have enormous power. The federal government has enormous power. And unless you've been personally affected by it or have researched it carefully enough to know how much power they have and what they can do with it, it isn't in our consciousness. It isn't something we think about. But in The Last Ranch, you have this ongoing struggle on the part of the Kearney men, Matt Kearney and his father, Patrick Kearney, to try to forestall the takeover of what ultimately becomes one of the last ranches on the Tularosa Basin that the Army up to that point in the story has not been able to take over and control. And I even go into the story of John Prather, who drew national attention to his standoff with the military in the late 1950s when he just refused to budge. And national correspondents flew out from Los Angeles and from New York, and it was in the Times, and it was on radio, and it was in the early stages of the television news industry. They was getting coverage, and it was just a remarkable story. So these were the pioneers. I mean, you take a guy like John Prather, he came into the Tularosa in the 1880s, and here he is in the 1950s fighting to preserve his way of life, having dug 1,000-foot wells, having planted orchards, having raised cattle, having built a stone ranch house with his own hands, and being told basically, here's what we're going to do. Here's the deal. We'll let you have your 20 acres that you can stay on and live on until your day on this planet is over, and then we'll just take it over then. And that's pretty much what he had to settle for.
Right, and that's what we see with the 7 Bar K Ranch, the valiant stand that Matt Kearney makes, and particularly you get the feeling that it's on as much on behalf of his father, Patrick Kearney, who really never knew any other way of life.
It was. I mean, as the story progresses, Matt and his wife, Mary, who, by the way, are Kevin Kearney's parents, talk about the fact that while they love it and while it's a precious part of their life and their heritage, that there's really no way, given the forces that are rallied against them, that they can stay and prosper on that property. And there's a very poignant scene with Patrick and Mary toward the end of their tenure on the land where we begin to see that not only is he decompensating, if you will, physically and mentally, but that there is a sense of loss on everybody's part of what's going to ultimately happen that pulls them off the land. I did something very interesting this time, Mary Charlotte, in my tour. I've up to now not read because it's been uneasy for me to just do readings. I've pretty much done talks, but I came up with this notion, okay, if I'm writing as well as I possibly can, if I'm doing my craft as authentically and as professionally as I can, I should be able to open a copy of The Last Ranch or any of my books at a random page and read from it and have those people who are in the audience find it at least entertaining, perhaps interesting, perhaps informative, perhaps even enlightening. And I've been doing that on this book tour, and it's been getting great reviews. People have
really opening at random.
What I do is I ask the audience to pick a page, and they pick the page, and I read from that page, and it can be like 200 words or 300 words. I've enjoyed it because it's just been refreshing for me to dip right into the story at that point and see what I was about, what was I saying, where was I going? And the audience has just found it totally mesmerizing. It's just been a great deal of fun.
That's interesting because when you dip into a book, you may dip into a lyrical passage about land, which everybody can relate to, or you might dip into the middle of dialogue that you don't like, if you don't know what the plot is.
Exactly. And what it turns out to be are these little vignettes of the larger story. And it works. It absolutely works.
Very interesting. We're talking to Michael McGarrity about his new book, The Last Ranch. Now, this was also, we were talking about how it was a transitional time in the state of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. It was a traditional time historically where rural people were getting, like it or not, industrialized and their relationship to the land was shifting. Also a transitional time for women who were starting to find a new independence. And it seems that the men in the Kearney clan, and they always seem to keep having sons, they're drawn to independent women. And I was wondering if there were any historical female models who inspired any of the characters in this book or in this trilogy.
The one that's a personal historical character is my mother, who was raised on a cattle ranch in Montana and grew up basically as a cowgirl. I found a little book, and I cannot for the life of me remember the name of the author. It was a little self-published book that I think she did primarily for her family called Meanwhile Back at the Ranch. And it's about this young school teacher in Albuquerque who marries a wrangler at the Bishop's Lodge outside of Santa Fe, who takes a job as a ranch manager at the Three Rivers Ranch on the Tularosa. And so here's this town girl who fell in love with a cowboy, never stepped on a horse in her life, never milked a cow, never fed a chicken, never did anything, probably didn't cook that much, who gets thrust into this world of being a rancher's wife. And it was all during the 1940s, during World War II. So it was all very appropriate to the research I was doing for The Last Ranch. And she just had all of these catastrophes and all of these challenges and all of these anxieties, and she prevailed. She just worked through it. And one of the things I know about having met and come to like so many of the ranching families in our state is that I've yet to meet a ranch wife who isn't anything less than a full partner in the ranch.
Well, I was going to say the word rancher's wife, I think eventually is going to morph into rancher.
It has to. Women ranching today are not only ranching with their husbands, but in some cases ranching on their own.
And when their husbands die, they keep it going.
Continue it with their children and with their grandchildren. So we have, a tradition of strong women role models in New Mexico, whether it's on the ranching forefront or whether it's having come out of the technological revolution that the 50s and 60s brought. You were referencing it earlier with kind of the Rosie the Riveter story about women going to work during World War II and how that had an impact on changing their attitudes towards their own personal lives and looking beyond just becoming a wife and a mother. That I think is still very prevalent in New Mexico. We live in Santa Fe, and the women in Santa Fe are some of the most fiercely independent people that you're ever going to meet. They're entrepreneurs, they're business owners, they're artists, they're writers, they're producers of radio shows, radio hosts, such as yourself. And I think we're such an interesting mixture of cultures that we have to be that way, because otherwise we wouldn't have the unique blend that we have as a society. We're very, very unique in that regard.
And I think that there's a certain kind of independence that is forced onto people when there is not a sort of monocultural tradition that you can fit easily into. you have to make your own life because you can't necessarily do what your parents did.
Yeah, we're not an easy fit for a lot of people, and there are people who come and people who go from New Mexico because we're just a little too quirky for them, I think. The other side of it is we're still predominantly rural in certain areas of the state. When you look at our population concentration, it's along the Rio Grande, basically, where I think two-thirds of the people in New Mexico live. You get out and away from that, and you enter what I consider to be still frontier areas, where the population is very low, where hard work is what's required to make your way and to sustain your family and sustain your life. And that drives a certain amount of independence, too, for people. So as you can tell, I've had this almost lifelong love affair with the state, and I've been writing about it now. I don't know if you realize it, but this is my this is the 20th anniversary of my debut novel, Tularosa. So
20 years.
20 years. It's been
and
20
more
years.
Than 20 books.
No, 15.
Oh, 15 books.
15, right.
Okay. I think of you as, at least when as long as I've been doing the show, you tend to bring out one almost every year.
That was true up until I started the trilogy.
And, okay.
We call it the American West Trilogy, with Hard Country and Backlands and The Last Ranch, which, as you know, covers four generations of the Kearney family and 100 years of history, from the frontier days of the 1870s all the way up to the close of the Vietnam War.
Well, one of the things that I appreciate about these books is, and I do see them in a way as kind of a long history of the state of New Mexico and of the people who came here from elsewhere and then really made their homes here, and the people who were already here and all of those interactions. And what I like is that there's a lot of love, but there's no particular period or people who are overly romanticized. The problems, the difficulties, the interesting parts are all put out for the reader to enter and sort of judge and feel for themselves.
I really appreciate that comment because, especially with the trilogy, what I tried to do very, very carefully and precisely is avoid all cliches. I knew that they were going to get categorized as Western novels, even though I think of them as family sagas and historical novels. Because of their setting, they're going to be called Westerns. But with that said, I didn't want to do the formula Western. I wanted to place these people in real situations and have them encounter real success and real problems, and just have them be fully drawn on the page and as believable as they could possibly be. So I have very carefully tread in areas that are outside of my own cultural experience. And it was important for me to do that because I didn't want to make assumptions that I knew how a Hispanic woman might act or how a Native American male might feel. By getting into their symbolism or their belief systems, I just had to do it from the standpoint of what I would think a similar person would feel in a situation akin to that. And it was not easy to thread that needle or traverse that ground because as a reader, I've just found too many characters that weren't believable. For example, writing female characters is not the easiest thing for a guy to do. And starting out, I wasn't very good at it. Fortunately, I had a first reader in my wife, Mimi, who could correct me and say, you know, Michael, no, that just isn't going to work. That's not what a woman is going to think. That's not what a woman is going to feel.
Speaking of strong woman characters.
That's right. Speaking of strong women characters, I'm married to one, right?
Yeah.
So it's very important for me as a writer to be as accurate as I can in not only describing the land and what lives on it or grows on it, but the people who are part of it. They have to be just as fully drawn as any beautiful sunset is described in a book. So it takes a lot to do that. And on top of it, it even gets harder when you want to write really, really good dialogue.
Yes, yes, indeed. There's some lovely characters in it. And Kevin Kearney is born in the middle of the book, and we know him from the detective books. And for those listeners who haven't read Michael McGarrity's crime novels, you have a treat before you. But I wondered how you, in writing this trilogy, and particularly once Kevin Kearney was born in this last book, how you drew on the books you'd already written.
I had to fact-check myself, basically.
Yeah.
Because throughout the 12 crime novels, I was always dropping little backstory things about Kevin and his life. And I did that deliberately because I didn't want to do a whole, here's Kevin's backstory in summary, and then you never hear about it again, because people don't reveal themselves that way. People reveal themselves in bits and pieces. And I thought, well, over the course of the 12 crime novels, that's the way Kearney is going to tell a little bit more about his story as he goes along. So going back and looking at the earlier books became very important for me, because I had to recall, well, where was he when he did this? And there are a couple of things flat out that are not cogent between the trilogy and the crime novels, and I just had to let it go. I had to say, okay, eventually I'm going to hear from a reader who's going to say, in this book you had Kearney here, in this book of the trilogy you said this, you know, and I'm just going to have to live with it, because there were a couple of situations that I simply didn't want to have be coherent or be completely identical to each other. But it was very interesting to dip back into my old work, and I was able to say, you know, that's not bad writing. You know, 20 years ago, that wasn't bad writing. So I had to fact check myself, and then I had all the other research that I had to do too.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, if somebody comes to you with those kinds of inconsistencies, all you can say is how wonderful to have such avid readers.
I thank them for it. I really do. I get a note or two a month from somebody who wants to wag a finger at me and say, no, that wouldn't work. And I say, thank you for correcting me. You know,
yeah.
I've yet to write a perfect book. I don't think I'm ever going to write a perfect book. What was interesting when this book went into copy editing, I had a copy editor who challenged me, and she said, I'm convinced that she was born probably after 1980, just from the comments she made as a copy editor. But she said, you said nothing about John F. Kennedy's assassination in The Last Ranch. And I wrote her back, and I said, yes, that's right, because not every major piece of world history necessarily had a dramatic impact on every person in the world. And there was no way I could put all of the major events that have occurred since World War II into The Last Ranch and make it be anything less than a million-page volume, and you'd lose the story of the family. You'd lose the intimate history that drives the narrative.
I think it's so tricky when you're writing historical fiction to really put yourself in the shoes of the people who are living things when you have the privilege of hindsight. Because unless you were there yourself, you can't quite imagine what it was like to really not know how World War II was going to come out,
right?
For example.
Right. And the fear and the apprehension that people had about Benito Mussolini and Adolf Hitler and the Emperor of Japan and the terrible costs that were being paid. One of the things that bothers me about our new professional military is that so it's so few people that are paying the price. And we go about our lives pretty much immune to any kind of direct impact that the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq has had, where we have these other people who are constantly put in harm's way on our behalf. I'm a big fan of national service. And it doesn't have to be in the armed services, but I think we lose something as a culture if we don't ask our citizens to somehow participate in our society, in building our society. But whether it be a teacher, the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, or Civilian Conservation Corps, or the military, if you like, we, I think, ought to be asking our citizens, our young citizens, to give some service to their country. I think it would be a very smart thing to do.
And all the men in the Kearney family going way back were veterans of one kind or another, and you see Kevin Kearney basically desperate to go into combat. You sort of feel like almost just so that he could say that he had.
And that's a very typical response of young men, particularly. One of the things that's interesting about New Mexico, we have one of the highest rates, and it's still true today, one of the highest rates of enlistment in the military and service during wartime of any state in the country. The tradition has been very strong here for generations, and it still is today. So that's another particularly interesting little tidbit about the New Mexico experience for us.
So you have written all these Kevin Kearney crime novels. You've now written the prequel trilogy, the three books, the last of which is The Last Ranch, which we've just been talking about. What's next for you?
Well, it's a funny story, and I've got to tell you this story. I started to do a single prequel. I wanted to step aside from the crime novels and do just one book that was going to talk about what happened to Kearney after he came back from Vietnam that caused him to want to become a police officer. So I make the proposal to my publisher. He loves the idea. Let's do it. I get about 300 manuscript pages into what was going to become Hard Country and realize I can't do this in one book. So he's looked at the pages. He loves them. I propose to him through my agent that it become a trilogy. And because of his publishing history, he jumps on the idea. He loves it. He said, let's do it. So I signed another contract for two more books, and I'm going to do a trilogy. Monstrous undertaking, Mary Charlotte. Monstrous.
Hundreds of pages each.
Yeah, monstrous undertaking. I was terrified that I wasn't even going to be able to do it half of the time. Anyway, so Hard Country comes out. Backlands comes out 2 years later. Last Ranch comes out just weeks ago. And I still have yet to tell the story of what happened to Kevin Kearney that caused him to want to become a cop. That's the next book.
Excellent.
That's the next book. And I've already got it underway. It's called Residue, and it will be a cold case mystery that turns Kevin Kearney into a suspect in a homicide.
Ladies and gentlemen, there's your teaser. Stay tuned, and we look forward to talking to you about that book whenever it comes out. Michael McGarrity's latest book is called The Last Ranch. He can be heard this coming Friday, the 3rd of June, at Barnes & Noble's in Albuquerque at 7 in the evening, and then on Saturday, June 4th at 3 o'clock at Tome on the Range in Las Vegas, New Mexico. And then the following Saturday, the 11th of June at 1 o'clock at Opposite Books in DeVargas Mall. And then Sunday, June 12th, Bookworks in Albuquerque at 1 in the afternoon. Lots of public appearances to choose from wherever you may live, ladies and gentlemen. You can also find more information at michaelmcgarrity.com. Michael, thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be back. Great to see you. Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.